Hello and welcome to the Car Culture Podcast. With me, we have a special guest today. But first, I think I would like to introduce Dan, my co-host. Dan, would you like to introduce yourself?
My co-host?
I mean, why not?
Okay, yeah, I'm Dan.
Hi, I'm still co-host. Dan. And with us today on one of our first podcasts, we have Mr. Yassin, Aseel himself. I think everyone who's watching this probably knows who Aseel is, but would you like to introduce yourself, Aseel?
I'm Aseel Yassin. I like old cars. And I like Dan. Alex, not so much. I think that about sums me up.
I think that's because of the distance between us. I've never had so much.
Can we
distance
not forget producer
us.
Ahmed that doesn't want to be on
hey,
camera?
Hey, and most importantly, we have Mr. Producer Ahmed who's having a bit of chocky.
Fasting.
Say hi.
Hello.
There he is. Okay, let's start talking about some stuff. Look at that. Perfect timing.
Yeah, great. So it would have been even cooler if we just kept our mouths shut.
But when we were making the shortlist of different guests we'd have on the podcast, your name did pop up almost immediately. But when we were discussing what we're going to talk about, that was a separate issue. And I think what's probably the most interesting thing to start with, Mr. Yassin, is classic cars. And I think let's start with them broadly.
Hang on, why don't we just start with your background briefly? Just
yeah, introduce yourself. Yeah.
Like our followers, we've got a lot of cheap followers that are into JDM cars and might not appreciate...
Who Mr. Yassin is, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So let's just start with a brief background.
I've always been a car enthusiast. I studied geography and urban planning. Never thought I'd ever work in the car field. And then through luck and things happening at the right time, I ended up working for a pretty cool collection and showroom called Tamini Classics. Ran the place for about 6.5 years. Great place to work, especially, you know, you join as a 23-year-old and suddenly you're handed the keys to some of the greatest cars of the 20th century. You know, superb.
Well, debatable with our audience, actually.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Toyota 2000 GT popped up.
F40 as well. Mm. Yeah. No, there has been some cool cars at Tamini.
Mm. So there are many cool cars in the region and in the country as well. It's just about getting them out of the woodworks.
Yeah.
So many cars that people don't know about, because not everyone has an Instagram account, not everyone goes to these cars.
That's true.
You'd be amazed the amount of hidden cars that are over here. It's
great. And collections.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is you had a view into that kind of scene that us mortals haven't actually been able to, because you said, like, these things are scuttled away, but you've been able to peel back that curtain and actually see what this region actually has to offer, because I think all of us have seen some of the cars that we see a lot of, and they're not exactly the world's greatest, but I think you've been lucky enough to see what this region actually has to offer.
I think I haven't. I think I've been lucky for the transition I'm making now, because, you know, it's never been... what I'm about to say wasn't a sales pitch that I've been saying for years. I've always cared a lot about car culture in this region. Not only because we're on the Car Culture Podcast, but literally, I always cared about the car culture over here. And to be able to do something a little bit less two-dimensional than sales right now is pretty cool, because that sort of transition was perfect, because now we're facilitating high-end classic car experiences internationally as well, mainly between here and continental Europe. And so it's great, and the timing is kind of right now, because people are flocking here a bit more and more. Like I said earlier, more and more cars are coming out of the woodwork, so it's great.
So it's a different side of car culture. It's a very premium side, but it is still part of regional car culture. So if you had to describe what regional car culture, that side, looked like, how would you describe it? Maybe use some other examples to kind of give some context if you've seen it.
I think fundamentally there's a chicken and egg problem. I think there's things fist away from the chin is how close it should be, right, Ahmed?
I like the reference though.
or the length of a good beard. There's a chicken and egg problem over here, whereby you don't really have that many high-end classic cars that are driving around the streets over here, because there isn't really the infrastructure workshop-wise to take care of them. There isn't the infrastructure workshop-wise to take care of them because, well, there aren't really that many of them driving around, you know. So that does exist. There is a desire for it to exist. But when we're talking about that echelon of collector, I think they tend to prefer to buy, drive, and enjoy their cars in other parts of the world where the weather is a bit kinder in the summer, where there already is an infrastructure that can take care of their cars, where there is a culture over there for them already.
A scene.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, why is there not an infrastructure here? That would be my question.
Well, I think first of all, because we're living in a country that's about 5 years younger than my car.
Yeah.
And so you can't suddenly expect there to be a plethora of collectors who are like, oh, look at my Auburn. Oh, I've got a pre-war Bugatti here, and oh, there's my Lamborghini Miura. You know, it takes time.
And Auburn is a car, right? Because I think
quite a few of us don't know. Auburn is a pre-war car brand for the States. Yeah. So I think age is a large part of it.
I'd agree. And knowledge, you know.
So maturity with age, basically, right?
Yeah. There's just a lack of specialists here to a degree.
But is there enthusiasts? Is there people that are enthusiastic about them?
Because there's enthusiasts and money here, right? But you still, that money doesn't get you everywhere, right? It doesn't give you knowledge. So you can have as much money as you want here, but to maintain a car here, that doesn't help, does it, really? Unless you can just fly it out somewhere else, get it fixed and fly it back in.
But again, I guess if you're part of that kind of echelon, you said it, Asil, like these people are a bit more international than like us local car enthusiasts, because you've got different scenes in different cities here. But when you're up there, I guess it's quite a small circle of people in the world, right? And I guess maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're completely right. And as you know, it's not a nice thing to say, but oftentimes, it's not an echelon of group of people where someone with a few dollops of humility would like to be amongst on a sort of casual basis. You know, it really is that sort of upper level. But professionally in the field, that's the market that sort of makes you money, right?
And I think what leads us on from this conversation about the scene is the value of these cars, right? Mm. So there clearly is a market for this, like for these cars here, and a market is made up of cars that have some sort of value. Now, what do you think about the current scene, how these cars in the scene are evaluated, just kind of generally? Like, what's your interpretation being around this kind of world? Because unfortunately, I don't think we can separate the cars from the money they're worth, especially up there, right?
Is this from, like, my question?
Yeah.
Really? Like, so here, I'll put this in plain layman's terms. It's the only way I can do it, right?
I don't understand what you're saying. Please translate.
This has happened recently with the JDM scene. And so, I think I know the answer to this question anyway, but it's quite an interesting one. So an R34 GTR has increased in price since COVID 100%, like as of now.
And it wasn't cheap before as well.
No, but they've been steadily going up, right? And then I just put it into a place where there was a time where I was considering a few months ago buying one because they're cheaper here still. Mm. Or they were at that point. They're not anymore. But then in my back of my mind, I had a conversation with myself going, why would I spend the same amount of money on a R34 GTR, which is probably
20 years old?
Yeah, poorly maintained, where I could buy either a Porsche GT3 or even possibly a GT3 RS for the same money, right? And you're like, it's a lot of money. What am I getting for my money as such? And this car 4 years ago was kind of worth, I think there were £30,000 maybe in the UK. Like,
no, there's a 0 kilometre one in Japan advertised for $450,000, $600,000.
And it probably will sell for more than that. Yeah, prices are silly, right? So then, and it just led me to think, like,
why?
But then I had a chat with Kylie, and because we were considering buying one, right? And then I said, well, you can buy a Porsche for that. And her exact reply was, but I won't feel like a dickhead whilst I'm driving it.
The Skyline?
The Porsche.
You won't feel like a dickhead in a Porsche.
No, sorry, yeah, the GTR, yeah, you got it. But you know that
But
what leads you to, like, why? Where has, I'm sure old air cooled Porsches went through a similar thing. And even I've looked at prices of manual 997s, which were relatively cheap here 2 years ago when someone brought his, I think 60, 70.
Really?
And now they're well over 100 if you can find a manual one. I've only looked at manual ones. I'm sure you can get
there's
auto
tons
ones.
Of auto 4S's running around and stuff. The stuff that you don't want, but like stuff you do want, it's up there.
So yeah, so what do you think affects the price? Well,
a lot of things. I think first of all, people who dictate the prices are the buyers, right? A car's only worth what someone's willing to pay. But the idiosyncrasies of the people who are in a position to buy all these cars vary enormously. I mean, just look in this room. You know, if all of us were to write a list of our top 10 favorite cars,
it'd be probably similar for us, but might be a bit different for you, mate.
Yeah, but you know, the Sid and the Hashim, I think, would be a bit different. Maybe you four guys would be a bit more similar. I'm not sure, but that
we wouldn't
really.
No, this is a man that's put a stupid wing on his NSX.
It has to come up at some point.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Can't not. Every episode, it's gonna. It's like clockwork.
But the great thing about that wing is, yeah, it's so stupid, but it's what you love. You know what I mean?
You my didn't car say so when you drove
it's a lovely car to drive, man. It's a beast to drive. No, but the wing is silly, make no mistake. But it's It's expression. It's self-expression. It's what you love. You know.
Well, it's in your idiosyncrasies, as you said, right?
But it's self-expression of yourself. And it really says a lot about yourself.
Well, look at it.
Yeah. You can have a big wing and make it cool, right?
Right, this is the last car culture podcast as well. But back to what you were saying about like a market being made up of people who want it.
People want things. And what makes a car go up in value is a multitude of factors. Usually it's a two-door or a sports car. So if we're going to speak generally first and then work our way closer, right?
But then you've got that 2.5 Evo that just decided to go up for like 250. So where are these rules? Because I know the rules. I know the rules you're going to go through right now. And I think just for everyone else, it would be good. But like, I can almost quote an exception to every single one of them. Because everyone always said that four-door Mercedes will never go
up. Of course,
up.
Because we're trying to create a formula for thousands and thousands of cars and a few decades of how the prices of these cars have fluctuated. And it's affected by the world economy as well. It's affected by multitudes. It's affected by who's president of the United States, for God's sake. You know, so we're trying to put a formula to something where there's no formula to it. And I think the reason, maybe one of the reasons we like to do it is because a lot of people like to speculate and wonder what's going to go up and what's going to go down. But the people who have reaped the biggest rewards from classic cars or collectible cars going up in value really have just been people who wanted to buy this car and back at a time where it was even considered expensive for its day. But they loved it. They wanted to drive the tits out of it. They got it. They did drive it. And lo and behold, turns out a few decades later, because they were loyal to this car and this relationship and this ownership, it's exploded in value. Yeah. You know, if you go into any endeavor with money as the sole focus, I don't think it's going to end well, to be honest. I don't think it's going to end how you expected it, you know.
But people do buy these cars, park them, and don't drive them in the hope that they will go up in value.
Yep.
And I'm sure you probably dealt with a lot of people like that, which I think is actually sad as well, right? Like,
you can't drive a bank account, but you can drive a car, right? And if you've got an asset that's worth, you know, whatever, but...
So Telly works in marketing. You can't drive a bank account. But I can do a lot with a big bank account.
Yeah. You could buy a really nice car, you can go drive. Do you know what I mean? That's the point. Like, the thing about art is you can sit and look at it, and it looks great, but what are you going to do with a piece of art? But with a car, especially if you like cars, there is so much more to that asset, which goes back to what we're saying, value. Because if you're talking about cars as a thing that like holds value and appreciates, lots of things hold money and appreciate. Pokemon cards do. Do you know what I mean? But a car comes with culture, comes with friends for quite a few different people, comes with an entire experience. So I think it's interesting because I can imagine working at Tamini, you probably spoke to quite a few people who are investors, right?
But speculators. Exactly.
Speculators, right?
I like that, speculators. Not
exactly, and the speculators, the ones who are pure speculators and have no passion in cars, that was rare. So we had collector speculators who went that into cars, fine, fair enough. But it's like what we saw what happened in the 90s when pure speculators came on board and started buying up pretty much anything.
Was that back when like the F40 was like £200,000 or something crazy?
I think the F40 was 200 to 250 list, and then it was selling afterwards for 500. And
I remember at one point, like I remember watching a Top Gear back, 15-year-old Top Gear, and they were like, oh, you know, the F40 is worth 200,000. Oh, how could it be worth that much? And now imagine their 40.
GTR's going for. Yeah. I don't know, it's silly, but. Still, that's a car that I'd never be at. Like,
it's the greatest driving machine I've ever experienced.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's like, I've sat in one, but you could never. Like, let's say if I brought one, there's no way you could buy one and park it inside wherever you are and just look at it.
You can you don't care about cars.
Nah, bullshit.
I had a car.
Why would you buy one if you don't care about cars? Right? You wouldn't buy an F40.
I know. I sold some cars to a client who had two F40s. Combined mileage of them was 550 kilometers.
That's a damn shame.
What does he do?
It absolutely was. It absolutely was. And, you know, he bought a few cars from us. But yeah, pure speculator. It shows off the mileage of his cars. And when someone shows off, when they're showing you their cars and they start to talk about, oh, this one's this low mileage, you already know. Blah. I sold a 550 or 650 kilometer 512M to an old American guy. It's a car from 1996, a 512M. And the only one ever made in that color. He bought it, proceeded to ship it out of Dubai, take it to his favorite workshop in the UK to do a complete mechanical, almost a mechanical recommissioning. I didn't really need it to change rubbers, good service and everything. Got in, drove the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. And I just loved that. I adored that.
So you kind of hinted on it, but and I interrupted, unfortunately, but like, let's go through that checklist of what makes a valuable car. Because you mentioned mileage now. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned collectability, but let's go through those points. I think
I honestly think the most important, almost a shining like a beacon of light through all of those multiple factors is the car being significant for its time over anything else.
Yeah.
A car needs to be significant for its time. And then everything else probably trickles after that. If I had to think about it and choose one main point, it would be that. The 300 SL gullwing Mercedes from the 50s with the gullwing doors.
It's the only 50s car you can actually drive.
I disagree.
Like, I mean, most 50s cars, and moves, well, most 50s cars are kind of like very backwards.
I've driven a 52 Beetle.
But a 300 SL feels like a car, doesn't it?
52 Beetle is much easier. It's much easier as a daily driver than a 300 SL. 300 SL Mercedes is a getting really heavy steering, right. And I've driven some heavy steering, but that's proper. But that was a car that was significant for its time. The Beetle was significant for its time. For
what else? Say. Let's say, so this first, but what else? Because you've mentioned mileage, but there must be a few other factors to consider.
Rarity helps a lot. Rarity helps a lot.
On the road, I guess, because lots of cars aren't rare. But finding an original Beetle, using that example, there was a billion of them. But now it's probably quite hard to find a 55.
When you say on the road, you mean one that's in roadworthy condition?
Yeah, actually drivable.
How about, so what's happened in America, right? So this is the reason why. So America never got a lot of JDM cars, right? So they have a 25 to 30-year rule, depending on what state you're 25. In, I presume. 25, yeah. That has solely affected the JDM market, right? Because they could never have it legally. And people were shipping in.
Well, let's talk 32s, because they've gone up. And why has that gone up? Because the 25-year-old.
It's not only the JDM market that it's affected. No, I mean, you know, everything from 288 GTOs to European spec F40s to European spec supercars and hypercars in general. It's cheaper in Europe than it would be in the US.
They're a little bit more unattainable, right? Though, and they're made in lower numbers. Right.
Well, actually, I'd say the opposite. They're more attainable because these people are so fucking rich. They could probably get the car in if they wanted to. It's just for us normal people that we've had to live with that 25-year-old barrier. Because with show and display in the US, you could just turn up with anything, right?
We had an Argento Nürburgring Ferrari Enzo when we first got it.
Wait, there's a different kind of Ferrari Enzo? Is it the colour?
Argento Nürburgring is just the colour, sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's like Porsche cars. You go, it's Miami blue. Everything. It was light silver. It had 399 kilometres when we first got it. And then I drove it up to 499 on the Yas Marina circuit. Wonderful experience. But anyway, we sold it to a guy in America. The guy in the US who ended up buying it was Axl Rose, the guy who the lead singer of Guns N' Roses. Yeah.
All right.
About to go on tour and everything. And yeah. So bought the car, but it wasn't registrable in the States because it was originally delivered to Japan. It was delivered new, not to the US or Canada. So his only solution was to take it to one of two places in the States that converted to federalization to $250,000, and 8 months later they converted to US spec. Sometimes these conversion places do nothing. They just maybe put a couple of reflectors and give you a bill, and then go to the federal government and say, yeah, we did that, but in reality, they didn't.
But that's my point, that like, I think if you had enough money and connections, you could get any car in. But now, with the 25-year rule, with 32s, which is a bit more of a common person's pursuit,
they made a lot of them, but
there's also something that normal people really want. Do you see what I mean? Like,
yeah, with the JDM stuff, I think a lot of it is down to the PlayStation generation, for lack of a better term.
This is why he reckons
you got the 32.
Putting a big wing on an NSX is cool.
I think currently it's probably people between the age of 20 and 35 or 20 to
driving
40.
Driving the JDM market.
Yeah, I think so. Because why a pre-war car is not worth? I mean, this has been said so many times. It's like
not the cars of people.
Yeah, exactly. There isn't the know-how either. The know-how is going away, and just the passion for it. I was sitting today with a colleague, Mo, and he was saying, I give zero fucks about pre-war cars. Now I give some small piddly little. Fuck scattering around. I don't adore them, or I'm not a master in them. But it's understandable. You know, we're our age. Geez, I'm 30, so I mean, you know, I'm
you 30?
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
I look 50, but
how old are you?
31.
31.
I'm fucking 35.
Full head of hair, mashallah.
Yeah, just about.
But bad for business, by the way. In my mind, it's bad for business. I mean, when I was sitting down, especially as a 25-year-old,
selling kid.
Yeah.
And he's schooling us about F40s.
He's driven them right before 30. But to that point, there's going to be a stage in time when the Miura will be less money, or less money than a Diablo, because people will have a better or a stronger appreciation and a stronger connection to the Diablo they had on their wall than a Miura, which they didn't.
Yeah,
because that's going to happen, right?
Is
250
it,
GTOs. Well, there we go. Let's ask a seal.
You're considering it. By that definition, there's,
so a, have a, Diablo.
There's a sort of... The Diablos are incredible.
Yeah. And there's a lot...
SV.
There's a lifestyle that fits the Diablo. That would
Which we won't discuss on the podcast, and we have. That episode will not be released.
Oh, Guildford.
Yeah, Guildford. Yeah. Good code word, yeah. So that kind of crossover period.
Yeah, so again, you know how I was saying earlier that the values of these cars and the way it gets dictated is also heavily dependent on the period of time as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Miura has received more mass exposure in its time than, say, something that was 40 years older than it. So it isn't a sort of staggered sort of...
Is it just the thing of, like, if you really want something, you just go and buy it, right? And that's pretty much... That's what it came down to me. And everyone, has a different mindset. And I guess when there's... Who are you growing up and you really aspire to? People do. I've mm-hmm. never done this, by the way. This is really weird. I don't know if we spoke about this on another podcast, but I never liked JDM cars.
Yeah, you did last time.
Yeah, okay, until I moved here, right? So, like, I've never... The F40 was a poster car when I was a kid, but I always knew I'd never own one. That's just reality, right? I'm not, oh yeah, one day I'm going to own an F40. No, it ain't fucking happening. So, but I never grew up aspiring to have a car. I don't know if you did, a certain car.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely did. Yeah.
But there are people that do that,
right?
Well,
no, I think because, like, to that point, I think we go through stages in life and we want different cars. Like you said, like, as you mature, you kind of get out of the cars... There's a cut-off of hot hatch. Do you know what I mean? Like, once you hit 30...
They are shit.
But up until 30, everyone wants a hot hatch because they're attainable, they're cool, but your appreciation, your taste change. But what's interesting now is when we've hit 30, we went Gran Turismo.
Well past.
Everything in that game. Anything in Need for Speed, I want it.
SVT Cobra to Tommy Kyra.
The Ford GT90. From Need for Speed 2. Oh, no, Hot Pursuit.
Or from real life as well.
Oh, my God, yeah, from real life. But
I'm a bit older, so I played Road Rash.
Yeah.
I remember that on the Mega Drive.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, they've got a new one, actually.
But,
like, at some... I think, like, the best example I've got is classic muscle cars at one point were dirt cheap in the 80s. Those people, guess they're boomers. I actually don't know what they're called. But at some point, they reached, you know, a stage in their life when they appreciated, had enough money to buy them. And that market went bonkers. Kind of like the way I see it is the same way JDM is happening now. All those people wanted...
Gran Turismo boys are now being able to buy their dream cars. Yeah.
Yep. So those, like, Mustangs
or whatever. You
still
find loads of teenagers or people in their early 20s who love old muscle.
What are they going to like now? Hmm? What are the 20-year-olds going to like now? The people who are 10 now, what are they going
to... I think we actually live in a really dark place when it comes to automotive. Because there's a real lack of good new cars.
Sorry, I'm curious. I bookmarked this while you were talking, but what made the change for you? How come when you moved over here, then you had the move to JDM cars?
So I grew up through, like, the Volkswagen scene. So, like, old Mark 1 Golfs, which was just, you just slam them on their ass. And for some reason, I thought they were the greatest thing since sliced bread. And then, why did that change? JDM cars are better. Rear-wheel drive cars are better in general.
When you moved here?
Yeah. So, I think here I'd never been exposed. So, no, when I was in the UK, we never had a Datsun scene, right? And the Skylines were probably a bit, at that time, was a very tacky kind of, like...
It was more Euro.
I was in the Euro scene because if you're into the JDM scene, it really was the let's go down Halfords car park, do a burnout. We used to put trays underneath the rear wheels because we had front wheel drive cars, right? But that was the lifestyle. And then I guess when I moved here, I saw there's a good classic Datsun scene here. And ended up, I guess, buying a Datsun. But that didn't change me. It was the BRZ, which is the new 86, really, basically. And I had that as a daily. And then I was like, fuck me. Japanese people know how to make a great driving car. Ignore the power. And it's really funny, right? Because it took me 6 or 7 years to get to that point. And I remember when the 86 was launched and I was like, actually, it looks like a cool car and you only have to put some wheels on it lower and it looks great. And I was like, but I'm not buying a car that's 200 horsepower, right?
Supercharger.
I was still, yeah, but that was actually the worst thing I ever did to the car. Probably shouldn't say that on camera either, but anyway.
That's because the car didn't need it. It's not Supercharger's fault. Yeah.
So, but then, yeah, I was like, I don't want to drive a car with 200 horsepower. You're like, oh, a typical fucking Brit came from England, like, oh, I'm living in Dubai, living the life, going out and getting pissed. And I wanted an Audi S3, a brand new Audi S3. How fucking sad is that? Shouldn't even be saying this on camera, right?
RS3, though, it's got a half a...
I didn't even want an RS3, I just wanted an S3, right? Don't know why, it's just that, oh, I'm living the British lifestyle in Dubai. Yeah, and then I brought a BRZ, and it's probably the best car for the money as well, it's cheap. And it's just good fun.
People buy what they like.
Do you think that's a future classic? Like there is.
I think the 86 will be, but a long because it's the
100% in 20 years.
But then we have to define what you mean by future classic. Do you mean something that's going to explode up in value? Do you mean something that's going to go up a little bit in value and then we ignore inflation?
I think that's fundamentally the
problem. As long as there is a group of people that like a car, and the main reason I would tell clients or guests or whatever back in the showroom days why cars go up is because, well, look, if you are a real enthusiast and you like this car, there's a good chance that there are loads of other real enthusiasts who also like this car. And then it's a simple supply and demand thing. Mm. So
and it's demand of experience is what I think is most important, right? Because you can get how hard is it to get an F40 experience? Probably very hard. Right?
Experience?
Like the experience you get driving an F40. I don't know. I've not driven one, but you have. Mm. Like that must be very hard to match. Right.
It is. The only thing that came close was a Diablo GT. Well, I've been told this Senna, the McLaren Senna, apparently is.
But the 86 in 20 years, when that might be worth something, that would probably be a very hard experience to match with whatever electric things, like shoeboxes, are driving around. So is it about how many people want a similar experience? Because that's kind of where my brain's going.
I think it's more nostalgia-based than the similarity of experience, man.
Because, like, you can get the with the classic Volkswagen, right? There are quite a few different cars that feel the same.
I was just thinking about, I used to have a Mark II Polo. So it's 89, maybe, I think. I'm not too sure. But it was, stripped out. It had twin Webers on it. It was a 1.3. And it had a 70 shot of NOS in it. And, I could never use a NOS on the road, by the way. But
it was carbureted and had
NOS. Yeah. Just used to spray it into the intake.
Spray into yourself and just go for it.
And there was a solenoid. The guy. So I brought it off a guy, and he used to race it at Santa Pod. And at once at Santa Pod, the solenoid for the NOS got stuck open, and it just the fucking revs just went through the roof, and the engine just blew up. But it's £50 to replace the engine, right?
Well, you just get the key and go off.
No, it's just I've no idea. You sat on the line, right? He's panicking.
Okay.
And it doesn't take a lot to blow up a 1.3 engine, right? It's literally like, oh, there goes the engine, right? Done. So, but that car was possibly, when you think about experience and driving it, it was actually good fun.
That's my point. That's what the value was, is how much fun is that driving experience?
Yeah, but just because the car's more valuable doesn't make it more fun, for sure.
Sorry, the producer over here is losing.
Yeah, hold on. I want to know what says. We have a kerfuffle over this side.
Come on, Armin.
Studio audience, what's happening?
Speak.
We're laughing about how you described your engine blew out.
Well, it wasn't mine, it was the guy's. He had it before.
Yeah, but the way you described how the engine hit the rev limiter.
Our friends. Yeah. Fucking hell, we can't go into because this one we're trying to publish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was when I was young, right? So, you know, like these kids are doing it here, although he's a little bit, we're not going to get into that. That is a different
That's a different podcast.
Game. Yeah, yeah.
There are cars for 300,000 dirhams that give you 10 times the fun of a car of 3 million.
Yeah.
And again, it's a subjective thing, but it's also...
Well, I mean, like, to kind of give some more structure, I'd say from a sales perspective of a person that's been able to indulge in quite a few different cars, what do you think, for you, made the biggest impact and was, like, what's the coolest experience? Top five. Top five best experiences. And we'll first do the, upper echelon, and then we'll do normal stuff we can afford. But, top five greatest driving experiences.
S2000 daily.
Yeah, you know, S2000 double Jace. The first time I did Jace was in the S2000. That was fucking sublime. But then I did the Jace at Daytona, and that was a whole other level of sublime, divine experience.
Daytona
up double Jace. When I was put on a mission to empty the fuel tank of a Bugatti Veyron before it would fly out of the country, that was fantastic.
Did you go over a roundabout in it?
No. That was its younger sister that happened later, and then injured one of my idols. Actually, I despite the fact that I've been very lucky with classic cars, I do adore and worship the Bugatti Veyron. I really do.
I think that's the point. As a person who experienced it, does it feel like a fast golf, or does it feel like something completely different?
A fast golf.
It's as easy to drive around an area that has a wide enough lane as anything.
That was the design steering, brief, right?
I want 400 kilometers an hour. I want a car that can be driven every day. I want the AC to be perfect and better than anything we built. I want the heater to be perfect and better than anything we built. It has to do 400 kilometers an hour, and it has to have 1,000 horsepower.
And I have to be able to drive my wife to the opera was Ferdinand Piëch, his actual design thing. I need to be able to drive my wife to the opera in this car.
Need to get a new wife.
Who, Ferdinand Piëch?
I'm sure he has multiple, But the Veyron and the Phaeton, those were his two sort of swans.
First one's what, Daytona?
Daytona on Jebel Jais, Veyron, generally speaking, F40. Definitely, I was lucky enough to drive that a few times. That was incredible. We're three now, right? We're three.
Throw in two you haven't done yet, but you think might be just like special. I mean, have you ever driven an F1? Because I think everyone...
McLaren F1 would
be... For me, like, if I had to drive one car and I would never be able to drive any other car again, I want to drive McLaren
F1. Yeah, the last two slots for me are McLaren F1 and Porsche 550 Spyder. Because I love lightweight Sid smiling. He's so happy, our Porsche guy in the background.
I can feel it in the back.
The heat's from behind. But I love four cylinders.
He's
love
a Porsche wanker, so we don't actually listen.
The Porkers.
Air-cooled Porsche one as well.
Four cylinder lightweight cars are sublime, and certain Porsches of the past are phenomenal as well. I mean, I'd never buy anything that's 997 onwards, but the older stuff.
I'm on the opposite side of that. I'd much rather spend the younger ones. Yeah, just because I think so. We're not going to go into the story of Guildford and all and the comparisons, the older Porsches look great. So not actually 964. There's a certain way you can do a 964. I think it looked great. But then I've been in quite a few different ones now, and they're kind of like...
So sorry to cut you off, but you're very looks-focused. And I know, of course, it's a critical thing, but...
No. Graham lent me his GT3 RS, and I'll be honest, even though it was bright purple, and I felt like a massive prick driving it. Like, as soon as you get out of the public eye, like, going home was just so much fun, and it would take so much time.
Big secret is the big wing.
Fucking wank.
All right, keep going.
But it is a car. It's basically a perfect car.
Yeah. So that's my relation to it now. And I think Porsche have done it really right. And then I guess I'm a Nissan fan. I don't really say it, but I have Nissans. They've gone the other way, right? The R35. Although Phil was telling me the R35 that he had over the last week is really good. But I've driven one, and it doesn't. All right, it's a great car, but it doesn't have that feedback of...
the fizz.
And even not like... What's
really interesting with that car is people are talking about how it's really old school now, and it feels like an old school car, because it's been so fucking
It's a 2008 car, right? Like, really, in theory. But then so is the 32 to 34. There's not much difference. It's a few things. But Nissan just do it well and make money. But, yeah, so the... Yeah, like, I think Porsche have gone...
The perfection doesn't have soul, man.
I don't know. I'd take one, but I just wouldn't want to be seen in it. That's my problem. Whereas I probably would quite happily drive around in a 964 or even like a...
If someone gave you a 73 2.7 RS for a week, trust me, you'd come...
We've been having this conversation with this idiot sat at the back here. Maybe...
The problem is people associate because Porsches have become popular, because they've gone crazy, because there's a whole cult following, people find it annoying because they associate people like Graham with them.
Yeah, hey, Graham. See, there's a lot of fucking idiots that drive Porsches in this country. I think...
Is that what you got off the air call scene? Like, the whole German scene got like completely written off when Dan met them here.
No, I just... Yeah, oh, fuck me. I can't even go into that. But listen, I think there's a stigma and it'll probably happen with GTRs in the future, right? Dickheads will drive them. In America, there probably is a lot of dickheads that drive.
There's 70% of human beings in the world are dickheads, and there's a good chance that dickheads are going to be driving.
Car people aren't good at it either.
Yeah, when I was at Café in a Machine last year, most people were lovely and everything, but there was this one complete prick who came in a California T or Portofino or whatever it was. And when people are coming in, it's events. Café in a Machine is this place in the UK. It's brilliant, car heaven. And this chap in a Portofino came in, and, you know, Marshall said, please...
It was red, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, exactly. And they said, if you go around that corner, you can park wherever you like. He parked somewhere. And then about 10 minutes later, he comes and says, what's it take for someone with a £300,000 Ferrari to get a good parking spot at this event? I'm like, what the hell? Surely in this day and age, there's no real need for someone to be that much of a cunt. But apparently there was. So he said, well, you can just drive out and drive back in if you want, and you can park up front. And he said, nah, fuck it. And he just walked off. So some people are completely not the prick.
Wealthy people.
And the best thing about Café in the Machine, they'll be like, 40-year-old men with their like pristine EK Civics, like on the grass, just sat chatting. I've actually got a big.
I want a Civic. Yeah.
Oh no, but the whole Café in the Machine thing is kind of cool. Like, would we get it? I think it's in the UK. It's hard to have that because a lot of people sit in their scenes. So like the Honda boys will all sit with the Honda boys, whereas I think Caffeine and Machine breaks that down as such.
Equal playing field. If everyone's just your car guy, you got a car, you're having a beer, you're having a sandwich, and we're all here.
But here, I think we're lucky because our car scene's so small that we do kind of integrate with a lot of different people. Like in the UK, you can just be into... So I was in the Volkswagen scene, and that was like, oh, the air-cooled guys don't talk to the water-cooled guys. You know, it's bullshit, like absolute bullshit. Seriously. And like, you know, but there's a volume of people there that if you drive a Mark 1 Golf, you don't have to speak to anyone else, right? Whereas here, if you drive a Mark 1 Golf, there's probably one or two on the road.
But you're integrated. Right? Actually, what I wanted to come back to was, we've talked about upper echelon experiences, but again, as an expert who's had more time in really cool cars, what's your five best normal car experiences? Something that us mortals could afford, right? Not like
I might be able to guess some of these.
Do you want to? That might be a fun game. Yeah. Go for it.
So how many?
Five.
Jup.
So I didn't even know you had a 1M and you wrote it off.
Yeah.
So that's got to be one of the best experiences. And I know where it was as well, that little dip.
That kink, man. That's one thing Usain Bolt and I have in common is we flipped and barrel rolled M cars. That's a punchy thing. I went from the 4C to that, and a 4C transitioning to a 1M. The 1M's like a Land Cruiser or a Rolls Royce. It really is.
Double the weight, probably, actually. Hmm? Genuinely. Probably like twice as much.
The weights, yeah.
870 kilos for the 4C. Yeah.
Fan of the 4C or not? Fan of the 4C or not?
I found 20 of them, so that's why I wanted to sell the 1M, so I could buy one of the 20. But then the 1M got totaled, and instead I had my boss buy 20 of them. I told him, I have access to lots of them, buy four. He said, well, how about we buy all 20? I'm like, well, you can tell by the accent, he's Taiwanese. And I said to him, I can't sell 20 fucking Alfa Romeo.
I think no one's listening now anyway. It was so into the
he's
podcast.
He couldn't sell that many. Could you?
Exactly, man. Because, you know, over here, they didn't bring the normal 4Cs. They only brought the launch editions.
Yeah.
So what was that blue one that I drove?
Spider, probably.
Spider. Yeah.
Spiders, edition. They brought...
You could tell from the fender front wing because it's got little, like, slats in it.
I wasn't a big fan of it. It sounded really...
Few other things, yeah.
It sounded really gay, that one. It had
but would you...
Exhaust.
So what... Okay, so Dan guessed... 1M.
I like the way. Change the subject. Let's not just slag off one of my brands.
It depends on what budget are we thinking? Because I wouldn't have thought 1M. I thought we'd be talking sort of $20,000 and below, or 100,000 dirhams and below.
Less than 250,000 dirhams. Because I think quite a few people here can stretch to 250 if it's something they really, really, really want. So cars that are worth less than 250, go. So 1M?
No, I wouldn't put it.
Top five? No?
I don't think I'd put it up there.
But the 4C is...
4C would be there. Oh, yeah. S2000 would be there. Mm-hmm. Fulvia, like mine, but with a better engine, would be there as well. What else is it? Less than 250,000 dirhams.
How much did you sell the NSX for? Probably quite a lot.
Yeah, we sold one for $160,000. And the other
you can get them for less than 250.
We know that. But they have stupid wings on them. The alternator doesn't work.
They are driven by robots.
What is it? What fell off? Rear suspension falls off.
That's someone else's fault. You know who you are. They are listening.
They're probably not, Alex. They don't
know. No one's listening at this point. It's too late.
Okay. NSX would be in there. NSX would be in there.
But to your point, NSX prices, man, since I've owned them, they've gone up.
Thank you, bring a trailer.
Yeah.
That's been the driving force.
Two more, and then let's get into like what's driving this. So two more experiences.
Clio RS. I borrowed Sammy Sasso's, the photographer, a few weeks ago, and it was wonderful. The problem with that car, it reminded me of the F40 in that that's fine, grow a pair, man. It's whatever. You just adjust to the car. Driver adapts the car, not the other way around. If the pedals are over there, whatever. You're driving there. You know, you have friends who are weird. You know, doesn't matter.
I'm not friends with them.
Oh, right, okay.
Just for the podcast.
Acquaintance.
Yeah, but you are weird. So.
Yeah. I don't care about that bit. I just don't want to be friends.
So one more.
Weirdness unites people, Clio RS and... shit. I mean, pen and paper would be useful here.
Have you driven his other one?
My little 86?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't put that there, no. No, underpowered. Not charming enough. For me, at least, you know, it's subjective, isn't it? I got
another shit car.
Something that I've never driven, the old Mini, an original Mini.
Yeah.
Which apparently is so much fun. I think
if you get the right one, though. Like, it has to have the right engine.
Well sorted.
I've seen quite a few VTEC swaps and they look mental.
Actually, that'd be great fun, yeah.
VTEC swap
1.6. I need something with a Honda engine in it.
Yeah, B16.
Ooh. You could do a VTEC swap Mini with
there's a few
less
of them.
Less than 250,000 dirhams.
Oh, yeah.
And proper.
Yeah. Anyway, go on. Where are we now, Alex?
So we're going to talk about bring a trailer. Because I think the next question is, how on earth do we get these things?
How on earth do we get what things?
These cars. Like, we talk about market, but markets exist in certain places, right? And Bring a Trailer has probably done more for the collecting car scene than anyone else recently.
I'd say the internet in general, right? Because Bring a Trailer is part of it. And
Bring a Trailer is a huge part of the not crazy value cars, the more humbly priced cars, shooting up in value. What are cars that have really shot up in the last, let's say, 2 years? I mean, 2020.
Well, let's do the last 10 years to give like a nice big sample. Yeah, but like, or five years.
Well, if we're talking the Bring a Trailer topic, I think then that period of time is kind of irrelevant because Bring a Trailer only started having a real effect on values internationally in 2018, you know? Yeah. So SVT Cobra, Mustangs, or the Acura NSX, R107 Mercedes, the old SLs, the boxy SLs. You know, many of those cars, the three that I've mentioned, have gone up in value thanks to Bring a Trailer, from 5% to 25%. No, NSX is even more.
No, a lot.
Even more. Because these lower mileage cars have come out of the woodworks, and it's a typical, you see it all the time, where the perfect zero mileage car comes out, everyone buys it for a huge premium, and then every Tom, Dick, and Hammy thinks his car is
worth F40, the McLaren F1, that yellow Japanese one that just turned up. Oh, here's one with 0 miles on it. Just emerged.
This is different. I know from the Datsun, like Series 1 Datsun kind of scene, like it just pushed the price of Datsuns up overnight. Someone paid like $50,000 or $60,000 for one, and then that was it. That's the bar, right?
And last year, some old Datsun sold for, I think it was a 240 or 280, sold for 400.
Sold for about 240.
Yeah. But the McLaren F1 is an interesting one. That was that had the fingers of Bernie Eccleston and powerful Japanese families involved. There's a cool story on that.
And the price of that? Or in like the ownership history?
The ownership history, I think.
Because I remember I heard the story about how those were sold. So supposedly there was Japanese businessmen who were taken to Suzuka. Their F1 team were like told, to, McLaren team were told to just drive it around a lot. He stood in tinted window with a cigar and says, "Yes, I want one." And then bought it. That's how they sold those cars.
Yeah. You have to really believe in the guy's dream when he's sitting down and selling it to you and talking to you about it. You must have a real faith. Which I guess you can have faith in him because, you know, he's won a few championships on his belt. Yeah. He was a lovely man, by the way. He visited us in 2018 during the Grand Prix weekend. And he's supposed to be with us for 30 minutes, ended up being there for an hour and a half. He was great, talking everything from Beatles to... It was funny because he created the SLR McLaren, right? And I intentionally positioned the SLR and the SLR 722 next to each other in honor of his rival. You know. Didn't give a fuck about the 722. Talked to me for 20 minutes about the SLR and how it's one of the safest cars on the planet, this. He wasn't involved in the 722 and he didn't like it. And I didn't ever like the car either. When you drive the two of them back to back, the 722 has this identity crisis and doesn't know what it's doing. Whereas the SLR is, I'm brutish, I'm insane, I'll go sideways even though I'm going forwards. It's wonderful.
Have you asked Alex about his F1 experiences?
Can you tell me about your F1 experiences, please, Alex? Yes, sir.
Oh, your one when you nicked the car?
Listen, I didn't see the car, number one. Yeah. Like, and I love the way my experience is he interviewed Kimi Raikkonen.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And you were Hosni Mubarak, weren't you?
I was drinking champagne, yeah.
No.
That's quite good.
Thank you. Ash was with us as well. Oh, okay.
Live studio audience, Car Culture Podcast, everyone.
Yeah, we had that whole story before we came up here, didn't we, Alex?
Kimi Raikkonen was the first F1 driver I witnessed in real life as well. In 2009, before the Grand Prix,
Is that Lotus days?
No, Ferrari days.
Really?
Yeah, in Marina Mall in Abu Dhabi, you would go on these small simulator things and you know, the public would go and set a lap time. And whoever, the top two drivers who got the best lap times would race against Kimi Raikkonen. And so he comes in and, you know, he's bored as hell, you know, as he is. And he goes and he sits down and he races against these two other dudes and then
whips them, absolutely whips them, right?
Oh, yeah. Completely.
So, as a Car Culture Podcast, I think we're like wrapping up and we've got about 10 more minutes left. If we bring this back, all the cars we've talked about, what do you think of car culture here? As a person that's lived here, been a part of the scene.
In 10 minutes?
Yeah, you can do it in three.
Shit.
You know, I'm a car dealer. I negotiate. That's what I do. I'll give you three. What do I think of car culture here? I think it's growing massively quickly. And again, thanks to the internet and a few other reasons. And thanks to Car Meet and thanks to people like Flat 12 and things like that. you'd be surprised how many people you can geek out with over here about even the most obscure cars.
What's the name of the McLaren guy? The MC
Himasha.
Yeah.
Himasha yeah. Vidyaratna.
Yeah.
Is
didn't we have drinks with him? Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did. You were very Hosni Mubarak then as well. But yeah, he was there.
Hang on, you were? Because the next day, you were all over the place.
Oh, God.
I was straight as a die.
We went to the Flat 12. I hate going to car events when I'm hungover.
I've got some funny stories about that as well, but yeah.
Aye.
Sometimes it's the only way you can handle these events.
No. For me, it's that when you're hungover, there's a complete imbalance to the universe, and you just can't function properly.
I like being sideways.
Hmm?
I can deal with people in a much better way when I'm not thinking straight. If I'm thinking straight, it's not good.
You're talking shit.
Yeah, okay, especially so at
car there are geeks here, and you can
they're really on. You'd be surprised how many there are. You know, you could find an obscure car, like, I don't know, man. Insert any obscure car here. Let's say a Lancia Flavia. You know, you would, if you had the magical power to summon all the people in the country who could talk to you for 15 minutes nonstop about that car, it would probably be about 50 to 100 people.
I've got a question for you. Sorry, just to come up
on, I have an on answer. This.
Like, maybe we can spend 3 minutes of it. What do you think about car clubs in the UAE?
Because
I fucking
one of the most depressing things in the world.
You mean,
man.
Like owners?
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I've just brought a Focus ST. Yeah. First thing I do is I go and join the Focus ST club.
It's depressing as well. Because
I mean, does it happen anywhere else in the world? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, definitely.
I spent most of my, like, a large part of my life here, which is unfortunate. No, that's not unfortunate. But
you need to get a visa next year, mate. It's very not fortunate. You're very happy here.
I don't know. Well, anyway.
So car scene, car club scene.
No, I hate fucking car clubs. It's bullshit. Absolute bullshit.
Yeah, I agree, especially when it's a one brand or one model thing. I agree, because it's never people who you actually want to have dinner with. And then you end up having to have dinner or sharing your time with them.
I was part of the Volkswagen.
Bunch of divorcee balding men.
Yeah, it's bad, right?
Mustang club.
Yeah,
there's some of the Americans. We can't name names, but they, like, you know, there's like two different Mustang clubs, and they like don't like each other because
gang turf, man. Gang
Jimmy said something on social media about Bobby. You know, like,
the Coyotes.
Those are real names, but Bobby.
Yeah, no, yeah. I just think I don't know. Like, I don't know if it happens in the UK as much. I don't think it does. Like, although,
well, I mean, what's the point? Why would you join one of these clubs? Is the next question, right? What's the value?
Because if you don't have enough friends,
so it's me and you think
it's
the
nice
same.
When there's variety.
Alex's answer to this is, like, let's use Bobby again. He worked so hard
in his day job in logistics.
In his day job, where logistics was the one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then, but at the weekend, he's head of the Focus ST Club.
I'm vice president of the Lower Gulf and Upper Dubai region of the Focus ST 2005. club.
I haven't got an issue with Focus STs. I've never driven one.
They're wonderful cars. Wonderful cars. Yeah, I've driven a couple.
They boost nicely. They've got really fun. Like, they build power.
But I feel like I was being unnecessarily mean then. I'm not usually apologetic, but in this case I am, because the guys in the car clubs that I whose company or whose environment and atmosphere I don't enjoy are like you probably, like you said, people who probably are not living with cars on a regular basis, are not living with a community on a regular basis. Whereas for me, experiencing a bunch of them, very lucky and all that, and living with them, working with them, it's different. Whereas when it's something you look forward to in the weekend, bated breath.
But you spent some time with the Renault Club as well, right?
No.
Just with Sammy?
Briefly at the end of the Flat 12 event and the aforementioned hangover, so left relatively promptly.
So what makes a good car club? Or what makes
there
a
isn't
bad
such
one?
A good
there
thing.
There we go,
no,
that's
no,
my
there
next
is,
question.
I don't
is
think
there
such
a thing?
Listen,
because the thing is, cars are designed to be driven, right? So when a bunch of cars are just sitting on a lawn, there's only so much you can really do other than walk around them. It's when they're in emotion.
Seen everyone already. They're like, you've seen these cars. You turn up again, it's still the same car.
It's when the cars are moving that it's great. Now, if the cars are moving and you're a club, well, you need to be a group of people. Now, if it's anything more than six cars, it's just a fucking glorified parade, right? And you want variety, but you also need the cars to match each other's speed. If it's three guys in a four-cylinder old Italian car, and then there are, you know, four people in a McLaren P1 or whatever, it's not going to work out. So I think when it's enthusiasts with similar performing cars and not too many.
And again, like, you've had the opportunity to speak to people in a different echelon than us, but do you think that McLaren or Ferrari club is just the same as the Mustang club?
No, I know.
Are they
it
actually
I
like
fucking know it is.
I don't know.
I think the Mustang club is going to be much friendlier because
the Mustang club as well.
No, but let's say the club where the average value of the cars in that club is 80,000 dirhams versus where the average value is 800,000 dirhams. Then yes, you're talking about you know, immense wealth does things to people, right? Generally speaking. And I think those people are more protective and they're more judgmental of themselves and of others, and those they held themselves to certain standards.
So is it being exclusive and being like, oh, actually, you're not part of our club. You can't be part of our club.
I think it might be exclusive, but it might also just be... I don't know, man. I don't have an answer to it.
And the last question.
There is one important part of car clubs that we've all kind of missed. The core purpose of a car club in most situations is that you can share the knowledge base about your car. Mm. Now, that's missing a lot here, but it's very prominent abroad and it's very important. Like
in the M Club, I'm sure you have people who would advise you on parts and stuff. You go to the Ferrari Owners Club, I mean...
I haven't got a clue. I take my car to Altair. Probably not. But I think a lot of people are a lot more closed to it. I don't know whether, like, in the UK, there's a large knowledge base. So I don't know. The internet is a great thing, right? I'm part of the... There's a Facebook group, which is GTR Owners Club.
In the UAE?
Well, you're saying I'm part of the internet.
Part of the internet, yeah.
I have an which Instagram account.
But, like, it's bullshit, right? People don't sit there talking about their experiences and all. It's literally like, I've got a problem, how do I fix it? Where do I go for this? We don't, there's a lack of knowledge here. Just in general, we were talking about
chicken and egg.
You know, yeah, it's, that only grows with knowledge, right? But if we're talking GTRs, for example, the guys that live in the Northern Emirates, Saad and all, spot on, and they will, even though there's a bit of a language barrier there, they'll give all. If I ask a question, they're like, oh, you need to go here, you need to go here. Like, that's cool, that exists, but they're not a club, right? They're just a group of guys that hang around with each other, chill, talk bullshit, drink coffee, right? Like, so,
which is great.
Yeah, great. And so they're not a club.
Is it almost like getting rid of the car fixed it, or as long as just the car isn't your entire identity?
It's not healthy to attach your identity to an inanimate object, generally speaking, is it? I mean, we all done it, but it ain't the right thing to do.
Alex does it anyway. Yeah.
So, last thing as well, how would you fix it? How would you make car culture here better? You've only got 1 minute for that.
By feeding and nourishing the ecosystem, by bringing the best of overseas and cultivating the best that we have over here.
And what's the best that we've got over here, then?
Is the immense knowledge, the immense passion that's over here.
There's definitely a lot of passion here, I think.
For sure, man, for sure. For sure, and there's also a hunger to grow and do new things. You know, there's immense hunger to do new things.
I might sound really negative, or I've come across for the last hour about the car scene here, but there are some fantastic people here. I don't think, if you were, let's say you grew up in the UK, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now, right? I don't think
probably
so.
Probably not, no.
It's this... And you definitely wouldn't be connected to the same sort of people. I think it's very hard, or it's a much slimmer chance.
This place is more virgin territory, more blank canvas, isn't it?
Again,
it's a land of opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. The advantage of it being only 50 years old.
And there are some really cool people here that will actually give you the time that I don't think they would anywhere else in the world as such. So, even though I'm very negative.
Let's end on a good note. Let's end on a positive note.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we, everyone, be friends?
Go ahead.
Why can't we?
In the back.
He's waving his arms.
All right.
We'll end it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Asil, for making time and spending an hour with us. I know it's been torture, but we've had fun.
Fucking terrible. Yeah. It's been terrible.
Wait till later.
Yeah, wait till you see it.
Thank you very much, guys. I'm Shmi. Follow me on YouTube. Cheers.
What about Doug Kamura?
No, actually, you need to do the big tongue. Hello.
I like him and we follow each other and he's sweet, so I'm not going to...
What do you think about Doug DeMuro, by the way?
He is Jay Leno, but much younger. He's so humble. He's so down to earth.
He likes him, by the way, because Dan has got a different opinion.
So, you met Doug DeMuro?
I've never met him, but this idiot over here, Andy, has subjected me to his fucking videos.
I used to watch them, but how do I think of his videos, you mean? Or what do I think of him?
Yeah, no, I've never met him, so I can only, like...
Yeah, this lovely. Is the final note.
I wouldn't want to meet him.
He's
I
wouldn't
want to
have fucking dinner with him. Come on. There's, like, out of my list of people I want to have dinner with, he is nowhere near.
I'm sure you're at the top of his list, though. He just wakes up Dan, you know what? I'd love to see the quirks and features of Dan.
Yeah. You know what? If he came here, we'd have a fucking riot, though. I'd change his life completely.
He's great, man. He's great. And he's a serious enthusiast. Yeah, he did some of our cars. Lovely guy. Really lovely guy. I sometimes drunk text him.
What about...
When I totaled the 1M, I told him, because that was his top five favorite cars.
Didn't you do a load of stuff with a Supercar Blondie?
I didn't know. When I was still there, yes, she did our 599 Zagato. Yeah. But then after I left, she did another car.
McLaren Speedtail, right?
Yeah, she did that as well. Yeah.
And the Logan. I mean,
yeah.
I need to know.
But that she's, I respect her for finding a gap in the market and taking. I'm no interest in her content, but yeah, exactly.
Not that I'm giving
exactly.
her any credibility.
And there's a niche there. You know, she's. I don't think she's a car guy, but you know,
she's a lady.
Well, no, I use the term guy. You know,
in a broader sense, yeah. I know you've had that conversation about.
Yeah, I have two women who are saved on my phone as car guy name and then car guy. But yeah, no, hats off. Look, everyone's just trying to do their own thing and have fun, man.
And enjoy cars.
Yeah, enjoy cars and enjoy themselves. You know, that's people shouldn't take themselves too seriously. They shouldn't take others too seriously. And but
we don't
yeah.
take Alex seriously anyway.
Peace and love. Goodbye.
I see you.
Back to the studio.